You're listening to KTNA 88.9 FM Talkeetna. This is Sioux Valley Voice. I'm your host, Philip Manning. This week, my guest is Warren Keough, non-affiliated candidate for Senate Seat E. We'll be discussing the campaign and issues facing the state. We'll also be taking your calls at 733-1200, or you can send an email to dj@ktna.org. Warren Keough, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for the fresh brewed cup of coffee and good company. Thank you.
So, you are the fifth candidate for local state legislature that that we've had, which is that's everyone now. So, kind of a familiar format, I guess, for the listeners at least. So, just to get us started, tell us a little bit about your background, where you come from, and what made you decide to run for the legislature.
I am a 41-year resident of Alaska. I've resided for nearly all of the last 30 years in Chicxulub, in the Mat Valley, halfway between Glen Allen and Anchorage. Probably a lot of folks know where that is. I wound up in Alaska by accident 41 years ago after spending some time in the military. I spent a couple of years in Vietnam. Once in Alaska, my career goal was to be a paramedic, so en route to achieving that goal, I went to nursing school, became a registered nurse, worked a short while doing that, hired on the Anchorage Fire Department as a paramedic, had a long career with AFD as a paramedic and then subsequently as a firefighter. I left that to become take advantage of an opportunity to go to graduate school, so I earned a graduate degree and subsequently went to work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, where I had a second career. I worked there as a researcher and writer and paralegal. And I left that early once I was elected to the Matsu Borough Assembly in 2010. Served a term on the Matsu Borough Assembly, and that finished a year ago. I thought I was all done with politics. I was sure I was. So I retired, but once again here, as of the 1st of June, find myself in a political fray once again. So I would say, too, that I have 60 acres at the end of the road in Chicxulub. I've been married for 36 years. I have three adult sons who fortunately all still reside in Alaska. Well, that's a bit of my background.
Okay.
I think part of your question, too, was why...
Right. You said you had retired from politics, you were sure you were done, and yet here you are. So what prompted you to come back?
Well, a variety of things. One was at the urging of a lot of friends and others, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and others. And I think based on my history of service on the Matsu Borough Assembly, and I think I'm considered to have a pretty strong work ethic and tend to be fair-minded. So I was approached by several people. But also, I perhaps watched too much Gavel to Gavel this past winter. And it's been my growing sense and concern that the state of Alaska has gone a bit off the rails here with some errors of leadership and some wrong turns on the part of the legislature. And so I'm a mind if, as an individual, if you think you would like to change the process or improve the process, then offer yourself up there as a political candidate to represent the interest of the people and let them decide who will best represent their interests. And again, so I'm one of two candidates for Senate seat.
Right. I guess next let's talk a little bit about your platform. And the way I've put this to everyone thus far is if you were to give an elevator pitch for your platform on the way from the ground floor up to the top floor, what would that sound like? Your platform in a nutshell.
Well, two things I've made an issue of are public education and the budget. Budget-wise, it concerns me that we have record-setting budget deficits. We're spending our savings at a record rate. Depending on whose numbers you use, this past year we had a budget deficit of somewhere between $1.7 and $2.1 billion. We spent that much more money than we generated in revenues. The year before that, we also had a record-setting budget deficit. So we can't persist. We have to change the way we operate and we govern and the way we expend public monies. If we continue to do it at the rate and at the way that we're doing it now, we're heading for a financial crisis. So just generally, that's one of the issues. And I'm a lifelong fiscal conservative, and I would suggest to people, if you ran your personal budget, your family budget, or your budget as a small business the way that the state is doing right now, that won't work. You can do it once, you can do it twice, but in the long run, you're not being fiscally responsible. So I've worked long and hard to be debt-free, and like many people, you know, sometimes you have to borrow money, sometimes you have to dip into your savings, but fundamentally, you cannot spend more money than you earn, or you'll wind up in a hole, you'll wind up in trouble. So it's, I mean, that's a simplistic way to explain it. Want me to go on?
No, that's fine. And then, and you said public education is the other big thing for you.
It is, and I've been concerned about some of the legislation that's been proposed this past legislative session, and fortunately some of the most egregious bills failed, particularly SJR 9, which is a failed attempt on the part of my opponent to begin the process to amend the state constitution in a way that would allow public monies to be spent for private and religious schools. And the way I see it is, if we were to go there, if we do that, monies that would otherwise be expended for the public education system, for public schools, be spent on private and religious schools and outside corporations, that would diminish or really begin the process of defunding public schools in Alaska, something that we can't afford to do, and something that's explicitly prohibited in the Constitution.
Right.
So,
okay. So, and we'll get back to both the budget and education a little bit later on. But one question I have is, you're running nonpartisan. You label yourself as a lifelong independent. And how would that, if you were to get to Juneau, how would that affect, how would you caucus in Juneau?
Well, that's a good question. And again, first I'll address the independent part. I've never belonged to any political party, and I can tell you in the hundreds, thousands of doors that I've knocked on throughout Senate District E, and maybe we should talk about the dimension of this.
Right. Well, it's huge.
It is huge. It's about the size of the state of Indiana. But one thing that really resonates with people is having an individual knock on their door, or a candidate who is an independent and a true independent. I think people generally are really sick and tired of partisan politics. And one of the things I've heard even more recently on the part of Republicans is that I am a Republican, or used to be a Republican, but where did my party go? It's not the party that I used to know in Alaska of 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years ago. So there's some disenchantment with hardcore partisan politics. And so the fact that I am a lifelong independent does resonate well with folks.
Would you want to bring back the bipartisan caucus that used to exist in Juneau?
Well, we'll see who gets elected. You know, it's a little bit premature.
Sure.
You know, I like to think I have a history of being able to sit down with anyone. So that my whole decision-making process has been one of listening to what everybody has to say, you know, gathering all the facts, you know, seeking out what the best possible options are, and then making a common sense decision based on whatever kind of compromise or agreement you can come to folks who may have a very much or a slightly different opinion than you do. And And I think what's happened is that, and it's my sense too, that some of the legislation that has come forward, and especially the budget too, in the case the Republicans are controlling, you know, the House and the Senate, and we have a Republican governor. And so mm-hmm. when it comes to budget times, for example, and it comes time to when you join a caucus, my understanding is that you have to sign a document that says, yeah, when it comes to budget time, I will vote with the as the party decides. So I think it's I don't think it's serves the public well to be locked into an agreement like that, and I frankly won't be able to do that. I can't sign a piece of paper that says in advance without even knowing what the budget is that mm-hmm. I will vote for it. I think that's bad policy, and I think it's a bad way to organize. So
okay.
we'll see what happens following. And what do we have? 5-6 days to go.
Yeah, something like that. 6.
Mercifully, I will tell you that as a candidate who's been out there working awfully hard, and I think many candidates have been, but mm-hmm. Not only the candidates, but the public will be extraordinarily happy, mercifully happy when this thing ends.
People, I think that's fair to say.
People are really tired of being awash in the information and misinformation that winds up in their mailbox. The radio airwaves are jammed with nothing but political advertising. The TV ads are become appalling, actually, in the quantity and quality, and the people have had enough. I mean, I've had people chase me away from their doors saying, you know, if it's political, turn around and walk away. I said, okay, see you. But, so it's people have had a bellyful.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because it has been it's a very big election year, very full ballot. And obviously, you know, I was just reading something this morning that they think they've now spending on the U.S. Senate race has passed $50 million.
Wow, that's...
Right.
and what that has done, too, as coincidentally, it's kind of sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the room of the state of Alaska when it comes to, you know, discussion or advertising. Mm-hmm. There's so much money in play here that if you're a candidate for a House seat or a state Senate seat, it's the last time I checked, and I certainly can't afford to buy any TV time, which is extraordinarily expensive. It's not available.
Yeah.
Unless it's MTA DTV or something like that. So
right. Well, and even, I mean, in the governor's race, we've just now started seeing a lot of TV ads come out for the governor's race for much the same reason. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there is a strong challenge now, whereas before maybe when a three-way race, there wouldn't have been as much of one. My guest today is Warren Keough, candidate for State Senate Seat E. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 733-1200, or send an email to dj@ktna.org. I do have an email here with a few questions. And some of these I have on my list of things to cover. But there are two here that are not already on my list, so let's address those. These are from Chris in Houston, and Chris asks, how do your views differ from Senator Dunleavy? I think you've addressed that on education with SJR9 public funding for private education, but in general, how would you differentiate yourself on a policy level from your opponent?
Well, I suppose it depends on the policy you're talking about, but I think Mr. Dunleavy is a Republican, of course, and I think he's considered by many to be a very conservative, far-right a Republican. I know he's endorsed by groups such as the Conservative Patriots Group, the mm-hmm. Alaska Republican Forum. And I noticed in Delta here the day before yesterday where I was campaigning that there's a candidate for the House District Seat 9 who's Pamela Good, whose signs are attached to Mr. Dunleavy's signs. So I would characterize myself as more of a moderate, fiscal conservative, bit of a budget hawk, maybe a little bit more progressive, not as on social issues, not as... extreme as he is, but so I think just in a general vein, I'd be probably considered a moderate, whereas Mr. Dunleavy would be considered.
Yeah, and I mean, based on some of the candidate questionnaires I've seen, I think that's a fair characterization of his platform, and I think he would say, and has said largely the same thing. He does definitely label himself as a conservative. So I guess related also from Chris's email here, where do you see that Senator Dunleavy has fallen short in serving us?
Well, I would say I would have to go back to public education, I think. As for people that aren't aware, Mr. Dunleavy is the incumbent for half of this new Senate District E.
Right.
And he ran uncontested in the last general election. He had a free pass. So he beat in the Republican primary 2 years ago. He beat Linda Menard and had a free pass. So, but back to the specific question, I think on matters related to public education, as a new senator, within weeks after being, sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States, I was surprised to learn that the very first bill that Mr. Dunleavy introduced was a bill to begin the process to amend the state constitution. Mm-hmm. So we have amended that the Constitution a few times along the way in the past, and so there's nothing wrong with that. But I think as a freshman legislator, the first bill you toss into the hopper is something that's let's change the Constitution, and something as significant as this, where you would strike the language that says public monies intended for, I forget the specific language, I have it here somewhere, but that public money shall only be spent for public schools, mm-hmm. not private or religious schools. So to strike that is a severe, strong step, which I'm not sure a freshman legislator should be making. It's certainly not something I would do.
Okay. And actually, one of Chris's other questions ties in with where I wanted to go next, which is the ballot propositions. There are going to be three ballot questions on the ballot next Tuesday. And, of course, early voting is already open. Have you voted yet, or are you going to do it on election day?
I have not. I hope to wander into my polling place in Sutton. But I will say, before we get on to the specific mm-hmm. ballot measures, that I've been struck by the I'm not sure how the numbers compare to previous years, but I've had received a large number of emails, Facebook comments, and face-to-face encounters. I was in the grocery store in Delta the other day, and some guy, I have no idea who he was, came up, shook my hand, said, "Hey, I just voted for you." So there's an awful lot of early voting and absentee voting going on. So
for sure. So, like I said, there are going to be three ballot questions, and we'll go in numerical order. So Proposition 2 would legalize the sale of marijuana and basically cause it to be regulated like alcohol in the state of Alaska. Where do you stand on Proposition 2?
Well, first of all, I'm going to qualify my comments.
Okay.
And that is, I haven't completely read I'll confess to not having read that. I've been a little busy, but I will be voting no, I think, unless I'm persuaded otherwise here in the next few days. But I also think I'm not sure how big of an issue this really is. You know, part of my background is, as a health professional and a long career in public safety as well. And so, I mean, I get the part where it makes sense to decriminalize marijuana use. I get that part. That makes sense to me. But part of my background, too, is there are, even though it's against the law to possess marijuana, I've been in so many circumstances where police are involved with a fire call or an emergency services call, a paramedic call, where marijuana is part of the equation. But frankly, it's a law enforcement officers, whether you're a trooper or Anchorage Police Department member of the Wasilla Police Department, these are an obvious violation of the law, but are not they don't have time or the interest typically mm-hmm. to deal with that. So anyway, this is kind of a mumbled answer. Sorry about that, but I think I'm going to have to vote no on
okay.
this. And there has been input from some from law enforcement agencies, and I know some from the Native community, and there's certainly a large group advocating passage and another large mm-hmm. group opposing passage for very good reasons on both sides. So we'll see.
It's definitely been one of the definitely the most hotly contested of the three ballot propositions.
And I think I suspect it will be a close vote. I'm guessing. Well, you don't want to know what I'm guessing, but
so let's move on to Proposition 3, which is an increase in the minimum wage. By 2016, it would increase minimum wage in the state to $9.75, and thereafter peg it to inflation. How do you feel about that one?
I'll be voting yes. I think that's I can't imagine why we would not want to do otherwise. I do understand in the case of some small business owners with a few employees that does make a difference. But really, $7.75 an hour. I talked to a woman in a fast food place here a couple of months ago. I won't mention the person's name or who she worked for, but so I said, and I was just for the purpose of just querying and see where we're at. So she starts at minimum wage, $7.75, mm-hmm. working in a fast food establishment. This is a very busy fast food establishment that's, a national chain. And if you work there long enough, you might get a raise to $8 an hour. Mm-hmm. And this is a person traveling, a fair distance to get to the workplace. So, but really, if you're making $7.75 or $8 an hour, the typical perception is it's a high school student. And granted, there are a lot of high school students that have these minimum wage jobs.
Sure.
But really, if you're an adult, you cannot subsist on if you're working 40 hours a week at minimum wage. You cannot afford groceries. You cannot afford a place to live unless you're have two of those jobs and your partner does too. It's and I, as a person who has worked in the past for minimum wage, and I'm dating myself, but at one time the minimum wage in this country was 90 cents an hour, and that's what I worked for, and was happy when it went up to $1.10 an hour. But that's an easy call
okay.
for me.
So definite yes on 3, and then Proposition 4 is the Bristol Bay Initiative, and that would require legislative approval over any large mining project in the Bristol Bay area, similar to what's required for oil and gas projects there now. How do you plan to vote on Prop 4?
I'll be voting yes for Proposition 4 as well. And I, this comes about, obviously, because it is Bristol Bay and because we have this massive mining project proposed.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would view it as just another layer of government, but I think this issue is so important and so critical. We have this long established rich renewable resource, one of the richest fisheries on the planet, and on the other hand, we have this extraordinarily rich a mineral deposit there, which, if developed, would be this massive, massive project. So. If you do a risk-benefit analysis, fundamentally the question to me is, do you really want to put this sustainable, renewable resource at risk for a non-renewable project? In a way to make sure, whatever we decide, I think in this case it's warranted to have the legislature weigh in to make sure that that whatever action we take, the elected officials are more accountable for whichever direction we go. So
okay.
I'll be voting yes.
All right. My guest today is Warren Keough, candidate for State Senate Seat E, which covers the Upper Valley here. If you want to join our conversation, you can give us a call 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org. Let's talk a little bit about the budget, because you mentioned that as one of your priorities would be the budget, and talking about the state, it is running deficits right now, and I was just reading the other day that oil is down to $80 a barrel, which means probably tightening the belt even more. How would you go about that? Where do the cuts need to be made?
Well, that's actually my very first priority. If the voters decide to send me to Juneau, I'm going to have to bury my head in the books and do a very close look at both the operating budget and the capital budget. Because, again, we've had, with the way that we now tax our oil, and the fact that the production is decreasing and the fact that the value per barrel is going down, this year alone we'll have somewhere between, I think somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion loss in revenues that we would otherwise may have had. So we have revenues that are falling off. On the other hand, we have this trend upwards for both our capital budget and our operating budget. They're both trending upwards, so something's got to give. We cannot continue to dip into our savings the way that we have. We do have these, we are legally bound to cover some extraordinarily large costs, and that would be PERS and TERS, the teacher and public employees retirement system. So that's, so those, we have paid them down a little bit. But fundamentally, I think you really need to scrub the budgets. They're going to have to be looked at very closely, and we can use the capital budget as an example. And I think we've been not very smart, especially the last couple of years, on how we've gone about funding capital projects and prioritizing capital projects. I use the example of a kid running around in a candy shop here recently. We really do need to prioritize things and separate the projects that we really need from those that we really want. If we look at the anticipated cost for the large diameter gas pipeline, the state share and the cost of construction, if we go under the plan that we currently have, will be somewhere in the vicinity of $13 billion, $15 billion, or perhaps even more. That's a huge, huge investment.
It's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. But when you couple that with all these other projects that we have out there, and the Susitna Hydro project here in the backyard, it is an example of that. The cost estimates are, one I read was $5.2 billion. More recently, I've heard $6.5 billion. I also read an executive summary of a study by Oxford University that says there's no such thing on planet Earth as a hydropower project that comes in under budget if it's built. So if we estimate the cost of a Susitna Hydro project in the vicinity of $8 or $9 billion or approaching $10 billion, where does the money come to fund that project? Even if we only have to fund half of it, if we can get loans or federal monies or grants or but it's an extraordinarily large amount of money. And if people look at the, I think Steve Colt from the Institute of Social and Economic Research, he wrote a paper here a few months ago, and others have weighed in similar veins. It says basically, if we have to put in $2 to $3 billion for this project and we go ahead with these other big projects, it's not affordable. So, I think you really need to take a close look, going back to your question of...
Sure.
Of looking at the capital projects and prioritizing them. So I would offer that one project that we should prioritize, and it's very important, would be the Port Mac rail extension. Here's a project with a total cost of and it's gone up, as all capital projects inevitably do, but roughly $300 million. I think the estimate now is up to $320 million. The state, has funded two-thirds of that project already, so there's about $100 million plus to go to complete the project. The project is halfway constructed, so here's a project that we're very far into. Why would we not want to build this project? I know there's some opposition to it, but fundamentally it's a doable capital project that's affordable. It's a joint effort on the part of the Mat-Su Borough and the state of Alaska, and I think it makes good sense. And so why would we not want to put something like that on the top of the list, which, you know, $110 or $120 million to finish the project is no small amount of change. But when we compare it to the extraordinarily high cost of multiple billions of dollars for the Susitna Hydro project, that's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a, you know, let's finish affordable projects before we even consider the larger projects. And if you want to talk about Susitna Hydro, I'll be glad to talk about that some more, too.
we'll get back around to that for sure. okay, so you would put the Port Mac Rail extension near the top of the priority list.
Yeah, I would, and I really want to take a close look at some of these other projects. I mean, we have the Kinnickarm Bridge, and an estimated, $1 billion, $900 million to $1 billion to finish that project, and it's partially dependent on federal TIFIA loans, which appears they may not be materializing. So what about that? There's a lot of big questions there. And again, this is $1 billion to complete that project versus $120 million to complete the rail extension. And then we have the $500 million road in the Juneau area that's been.
I was just going to ask about the Juneau Road.
Well, I want to look at some of the details and specifics about these capital projects. Not that some of them are not worthy, and some of them probably should be built, but perhaps we could phase them in slowly over time. But given our, falling revenues and increased costs, we're gonna have to make some tough decisions. And I have to say that I was on the Matsuburo Assembly, and I think if people go back and look at the record, I think I'm the only Assembly member ever that's voted against a final budget package in the last many years. I think that was 2012, perhaps, because the budget was too fat. It didn't make sense, and we can't give everybody absolutely everything that they want. So some tough decisions are going to have to be made, and I think some legislative candidates have promised to do that. I certainly will be doing that, and I think Bill Walker, on the presumption that he's our next governor, he'll be making some of those tough calls as well.
Okay. Well, we're at the bottom of the hour, so let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back with my guest, Warren Keough. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org, and we'll be right back. And we're back for the second half hour of Sioux Valley Voice. I'm your host, Philip Manning. My guest today is State Senate candidate Warren Keough. And during the break there, we were talking a little bit about the Senate district itself. And you mentioned it earlier that Senate District E is about the size of Indiana. And we've talked about all the driving you've been doing. Just how big is this new district?
Well, it's big enough to have to make me buy a new set of tires for my pickup truck. Actually, worn them out. But it is huge, and it's kind of an oddity. You know, the most people that follow political issues at all are aware that the redistricting board controlled by the Republican Party was very effective in gerrymandering the states. There were a couple of litigious legal challenges to that. They modified the boundaries, but one of the perhaps oddities and leftover parts of redistricting is the Senate District E, which is made up of House Districts 9 and House District 10. And so we have this odd, oddly configured district. So we have, and I play a little game with this. Well, one, we had, you mentioned the size of this. I had fun online. I've entered the world of Facebook, and so we had a fun contest a month and a half or so ago. I was saying I'd buy breakfast and for the person who first figured out the state of comparable size. But Indiana is the answer, so it's a huge, huge area. But it includes half of the Copper River Basin. It includes most of the Susitna Basin, Matanuska and Kinnick River Basin. So we got part of the Talkeetna Mountains, the Chugach Mountains, the Alaska Range, and it actually includes part of the Upper Tanana River Basin as well. So you have far-ranging communities, and most people are very surprised. So if mm-hmm. I ask the people in Talkeetna, and I do this at community council meetings and city council meetings, and I have a little fun with it, and I say, well, if do you folks in Willow know that how many people in the room think that you're in the same Senate district as Whittier and Fort Greeley and Delta Junction?
Yeah.
And nobody raises their hands, and so people are surprised to learn that. So, and of course the issues that people have in Glen Allen or Whittier or Valdez are very much different than the issues that we have in the Susitna River Basin.
Right. So. Well, and you know, that's one of the questions I asked your opponent when he was on a few weeks ago. How do you reconcile the differences in some of those priorities? Because we're here in the kind of the far northwest corner of the district, and then down in the southeast you've got Whittier, which is in Valdez, which are port cities.
So, it is difficult to reconcile. I mean, the purpose of a legislator is to represent the best represent mm-hmm. your constituents. So. So it's tough. So when you can tell me how to reconcile the feelings of the people in Glen Allen, Valdez, and Delta Junction, who are expecting and hoping to have a natural gas pipeline and corridor come through the Copper River Basin, and they're not. I mean, that's an example of that's pretty irreconcilable, I think. But there are issues. You know. Commercial fishery in Prince William Sound in Valdez is not that's not an issue of concern in Trapper Creek or Talkeetna, except for maybe the few commercial fishers that are out there. Likewise, the whether or not funding for the missile defense program and stationed in Fort Greeley goes forward or not, you know, that's pretty much off people's radar in mm-hmm. Houston and Willow, I think. so what it does in a district like this, as a senator for this district, you really have to be aware of so many different issues that are really completely independent of one another with constituents with very different concerns and values. But I think one thing that works well for me is, you know, as the assembly member who represented the easternmost assembly district of the borough, and that's everything from Lake Louise down the Glen Highway, including the communities of Glacier View and Chickaloon and Sutton, Buffalo Soapstone areas, Farm Loop, part of Fishhook, and Lazy Mountain and Butte. So it's a huge area geographically mm-hmm. with a bunch of small communities. So in some ways, being senator for Senate District E would just be an extrapolation upward of the same thing with very different communities with very different issues, but this would be on an order of magnitude larger.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more. I've got some other specific issues, some of which we've already touched on, all of which we've actually touched on just about. But let's circle back to education. And one of the things that held the legislature over session time this year was the passage of the education bill and funding for education. And the big debate was largely about the base student allocation versus more lump sum type funding and how far to forward fund education. Where do you see the ideal solution as far as how we fund education in the state?
Well, the ideal solution in two sentences or less. Well, I think what happened was we need to understand that for several years the base student allocation was flat, so it's the cost of inflation was not rolled into that. So essentially, over time, over several years, the same or about the same dollar amount was going in, but there was no it didn't keep up with the cost of inflation. Mm-hmm. So we need to peg that. We need to inflation-proof the BSA, for one. And what we should do is get it up to a place where it has been in the past. And so that has been a push by a lot of people, particularly that there's a very well-informed, articulate, knowledgeable group of parents that cross party lines that were a significant presence in the legislature this past year, and they've formed a group called Great Alaskan Schools, mm-hmm. and I'm happy to say I have their seal of approval. But they want to see the base student allocation raised to a level that it was a few years ago if you rolled in the cost of inflation,
right.
And then inflation-proof it in the future. So I'm not convinced we can make the big big leap in one single allocation mm-hmm. 1 year, especially given our current budget situation. But I would like to get it back up to the level that it was at the past and then inflation-proof it. And I think we need to have public education is so important in this state, and we need to have budgets that are sustainable over time and affordable. And so school districts and school boards have some sense of what's coming mm-hmm. instead of the chaos that occurs. I mean, if you've ever attended Matsuburo School District or school board meetings at mm-hmm. or around budget time, or even in with the assembly who passes through all the
right.
funds
yep.
to the school board, it's always a bit of a crapshoot, and it's always a guessing game. So if we get inflation-proof funding of public education by inflation-proofing BSA, that would be a huge step forward.
All right. We do still have some time left. If anybody's interested in calling in, the number is 733-1200, or you can send an email to dj@ktna.org. Let's talk a little bit about energy. And, you know, we touched on the large diameter gas pipeline. We've touched on the Sisseton Dam. And there's another number of other projects going as well. And the cost of energy in Alaska, especially in big parts of interior Alaska, is very, very high. And the cost of heating homes is very, very high. What would your plan be to facilitate the energy needs of the state? Is it the bullet line? Is it the large gas pipeline? Is it Sisseton? What's your energy strategy for the state?
Ooh, well, that's a big question. Well, first off, whatever gas line gets built, if either gas line gets built, we're talking a decade down the road.
Right.
It's a ways away. But you mentioned the extraordinarily high costs of energy in interior Alaska. Well, part of the Senate district is in interior Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk to people in Glen Allen or you talk to people in Delta, that's especially Glen Allen, that is their single highest concern. And that is Glen Allen is a place that's shrinking demographically.
Mm-hmm.
People are moving out of Glen Allen. And the single biggest driver there is the cost of energy. It's unbelievably high. And so they're scrambling to find ways to either reduce consumption or find sources of cheap energy. So I think, it's such a multi-headed beast.
Sure.
This
well,
energy equation. But let me talk about something here, and that is some of the nearer term options for lowering mm-hmm. energy costs in the shape of LNG. So there are two things underway right now. One is it's called the Interior Energy Project in Prudhoe Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a project that's underway that is supposed to come online in about 14 or 15 months if they stay on schedule. And this is primarily Alaska Energy Authority, AEIDA-funded project and legislatively funded project as a way to have LNG and truck it south to Fairbanks. Fairbanks is currently building out their gas distribution system. They have a small one. They're expanding it, but as a way to bring natural gas to Fairbanks and other places in the interior and conceivably truck it to Delta, which is in this part of the, in this Senate district, as a way to lower costs. At the same time, at Port McKenzie, there's a private entity that says, hey, we can even do it cheaper. So they want to ship LNG north by rail to Fairbanks and as a way means to distribute it to the interior. And they say, hey, we can do it cheaper than trucking it south from the North Slope. Most people, or if you're not aware, the exploration and development of natural gas in Upper Cook Inlet is moving forward pretty briskly. The USGS has studied this. I'm not sure of all the results of their exploratory wells, but there is a tremendous amount of gas that hasn't yet to be developed. So, and certainly enough to supply, I think, South Central Alaska in the near future, and even supply Interior Alaska. So, Westpac, the name of this entity, is they say, hey, we can supply Interior Alaska for natural gas at the cost of, I think it was $14.50 per million cubic feet or whatever the equation is, which is lower than the predicted cost of trucking gas south from Prudhoe Bay at somewhere between 50 to 20 cents or $15 to $20 per thousand cubic feet. Anyway, that's part of a multifaceted equation. Part of it is the Susitna Hydro Project, and maybe this is a good time to talk about that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, fundamentally, I think it's a good idea if we're dependent on a single source of energy for heating our homes or our businesses or our public facilities. It's probably good to have more than one kind of asset. So on its face, Susitna Hydro Project says, yeah, that makes good sense. Let's have an alternative source of energy. Let's have hydropower long into the future in case our natural gas is not as much as we expect. It's good to have, you know, diversity of assets. However, what I can't get past, and I think an increasing number of people can't get past, is the extraordinarily upfront capital costs of the project. So whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, if we can't afford it, why are we even considering it? And in the case of Susitna Hydro, there's this, and I have to say that I was frankly stunned to hear Governor Parnell the year before last come forward with the project saying we're gonna go after the Susitna Hydro project in a different scale, but here we go, and we've already expended an amount approaching $200 million in this project, which is to me is, I mean, the concept is fine, or the concept is may work, but really we've gone down this road before. We've spent an extraordinary amount of money 25 or 30 years ago, whatever it was.
And there was a couple hundred million back then as well in today's terms.
Right. And now we've reached the point again, I think, where given the small, I mean, I think it was 100 and whatever it was, $150, $170 million last year, and a smaller appropriation this year. So we've poured all this money into a relook at the project for an extraordinarily expensive project that is not, it does not pencil out, and the project is not going to fly. I just don't see it. Maybe I'm missing something. If you can convince me otherwise, let me know.
Well, you know, and that's a sentiment I've heard more and more of late, from beginning with the last session, I guess, is that, you know, a lot of folks here in the Upper Valley are opposed for either fishery or environmental reasons. But what I'm hearing more and more from folks that were in Juneau, even some of our delegation in D.C., that it's not really worth worrying about at this point because it's probably not going to get paid for. And that's what I'm hearing increasingly. But yet at the same time, you're correct to say that even last year, Governor Parnell made it a priority to put more funding toward the Susitna Hydro.
So it's, yeah.
We'll see if that continues, or well, even if Governor Parnell is still Governor Parnell come January.
Well, there you go.
So, Okay, so on energy, I mean, there's almost universal support, it seems, at least in the legislature currently, for the natural gas pipeline, the large diameter pipeline for LNG. Would that become, you've mentioned short-term projects, would that fit into your long-term priorities for the state?
I think so, with conditions. And that sure. is the, I wasn't aware, though I've become aware more recently, that there, that the state really hasn't done any kind of a, when it comes to energy in Alaska, a due diligence project analysis. You can bet your life that Exxon, British Petroleum, and ConocoPhillips have all done theirs, and they would partner in a large diameter pipeline here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're all in it for roughly an equal share of a estimated perhaps $60 billion pipeline project. But the fact of the matter is, okay, if we're going to build this, how should we best negotiate this? Are we getting, I mean, we certainly want to encourage oil companies to further explore and further develop. And certainly as we share our resources with them, they're entitled to as much profit as they can make. That's what corporations are all about. However, we want to make sure that we get a fair share. If we build into this, this is an important time in the decision-making process. We want to make absolutely sure that we're getting the best, that we're making a good investment.
Hmm.
And if we do something stupid as we negotiate the cost of this thing, or if we're, then that can harm us to the tunes of hundreds of millions or billions of dollars into the future. And when you look at Alaska, we are and always have been a natural resource extractive state. We have this tremendous wealth of natural resources that belong commonly owned by the citizens of Alaska. So when we sell it or allow individual developers to come in, we just want to make sure that we have a fair share. And my sense is, and perhaps the sentiment of others, is that maybe we're not being as tough as we could be. I like Bill Walker's perspective.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Is because that seems to be kind of the line that he's taking as well on the project, is that we need to make sure that the state needs to take a closer look at the deal.
And I have to respect Bill Walker for his longtime knowledge. He's a Valdez guy. He was the former mayor of Valdez, the city attorney of Valdez, and he was much long involved, as others have been, in trying to get a natural gas pipeline, down the Copper River Basin,
mm-hmm.
and export LNG from the port of Valdez.
Mm-hmm.
So that hasn't happened, much to the great disappointment, I might add, to many of the citizens of Glen Allen and Valdez and Delta as well. So he says he's not going to go back and revisit it as far as putting the brakes on the current project and trying to direct it back to that. So we'll take him at his word. But I think what really rings true is, he's a smart guy, and he's dealt with the oil companies for a long time. And I think he will do Alaskans better long term,
okay.
making sure we negotiate and get a good deal with allow not only oil companies but other entities, that extract natural resources from our state, whether it's through mining or timber harvest or whatever. We just need to remember that we shouldn't necessarily let the tail wag the dog here. These are commonly owned resources owned by the citizens of Alaska, and let's make sure that we manage those assets wisely.
Okay. Let's see. I think that covers a lot of the questions I had on energy. One thing, there are a couple of things that have been in the news of late, both involving the governor's office, but with potential ramifications within the legislature as well. One of those is the appeal of the same-sex marriage decision. Federal district judge overturned the state constitutional amendment saying it violated the federal constitution. And now the state is appealing that decision to the Ninth Circuit. Do you think, I guess first, irrespective of how you feel about the decision, should the state be appealing it given the nationwide trend in that same direction? And then, I guess, yeah, your feelings on the ruling as well.
Well, it's not simply a matter of what the nationwide trend here is. It's fundamentally a matter of law. I mean, we are, we have to abide by the laws of the land, in some instances, whether we like them or not. But I think in this case, and again, I haven't read the case law. I'm just generally aware of some of the past decisions. So we do have this fundamental conflict between the vote by the people in the state of Alaska and the Constitution versus overarching federal law. And in this instance, the federal law is going to prevail. And so therefore, I think in some ways it's indicative of some of the litigation that the state has brought forward against the federal government and other things. And so my thought is, if there's merits to the argument, if there's a good legal reason, if there's a good possibility of a successful outcome, then good. Then we should follow that route. But if there's an overwhelming amount of case law, and the federal judge has made his decision based on cases, from what I know about it, again, without actually reading the case, that this is an instance where the state of Alaska is just not going to win. So if there's very little or no prospect that we're going to win, why would we want to initiate the costly and time-consuming expense of pursuing litigation? And I think it may play well to the public, but, you know, sometimes we just need to get real and perhaps accept things that the law of the land says otherwise. And we can change laws. We can do that at the federal level. But as if it's an overarching federal law, but I think sometimes we need to be smarter about when and how we decide to litigate and which battles we choose to fight.
Okay. And then one more question quickly is one of the other big issues coming up right now is the National Guard and the Alaska National Guard and issues that have been going on within that. There have been some who are calling for legislative hearings on that. If you were to get elected, would you want the legislature to get involved in figuring out what was going on?
Well, there seems, given everything that's happened, and again, I only know what I read in the paper, as perhaps most of us do. But my inclination is, let's air this out a little bit more. I think the governor has, or it's too little, too late in the case of the governor, let's find out. I think it would be, I really hadn't considered that too much, but I think that would be, why wouldn't we want to? Let's air it out. Let's see what happened.
Okay. All right. Well, that is just about all the time we've got for today. My guest has been Warren Keough, candidate for State Senate Seat E. If you missed any of the show or you would like to listen again, we'll be rebroadcasting Sioux Valley Voice at 7 o'clock tonight, or you can listen online anytime at ktna.org. I'm Philip Manning. Have a good day.